If you listened in last week, I told you then that I was in Chicago recently and was able to visit some museums, including the Art Institute. And there, I was struck by something. Wandering through galleries of priceless works by famous names like Rubens, Rodin, Cézanne, Monet, Manet, Matisse, Renoir, Degas, Van Gogh, de Kooning, O'Keeffe, Modigliani, Pollock, Picasso, Dali, Mondrian, Rothko, Warhol, some of them were, not that good. I mean, of course, they're good, and they're important, and better than I could do for sure, but I guess they didn't speak to me. But some others captivated me immediately. You're just struck by the beauty, or the horror, or the tragedy, or the sadness, or the humor, or just the feeling of the thing. But what is that it factor? What pulls us in? It's not just skill, it's something else. Maybe it's a muse. And on today's Saturday matinee, we're featuring an episode from the podcast Art Muse that examines a shocking painting of a mysterious woman, Madame X. Who was she? What was the scandal? And why did this arresting painting receive such a poor reception? I hope you enjoy. While you're listening, be sure to search for and follow Art Muse. We put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you.
What is art without the muse? Many of Western art's most famous works are depictions of women. But who were these women? Do they have their own stories to share with the world? Hello and welcome to Art Muse, a podcast that aims to reshape the ways in which we interpret well-known works of art by paying dues to the women whose images have been immortalized, but whose names and stories have been wrongfully overlooked. While these women's faces are familiar to viewers around the world, their identities have been largely forgotten. Together, we will appreciate these works of art from a new perspective, through the eyes of the women whose image stares back at us. Is the muse in actuality just as, if not more important than the artists themselves? And I'm your host, Grace Anna. She stands, tall, in her black dress, her face turned upwards as if she can't be bothered to notice the hordes of crowds that visit her each day at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. She is the epitome of class, style, and grace, a fashion icon whose dress has such timeless appeal that it appears modern even by today's standards. Suspended in time as a relic from a gilded age of the past, her effortless attitude has made her cooler than cool for well over a century. She is the American Mona Lisa, both bewitching and ultimately unattainable. Dubbed Madame X, her identity is clouded in mystery, only adding to her allure. But in today's episode, we give Madame X back her name and share her incredible life story. Listeners, today I introduce you to Virginie Amélie Avenio-Gautreau, an American-born socialite who sent shockwaves through Paris with her avant-garde outfits and experimental makeup. Her story traverses the Atlantic, taking us from the French Quarter of New Orleans to Paris at the height of its golden age. It is a tale of glamour at its glitziest and betrayal at its prickiest. In this episode, we will explore her rise to celebrity status and the infamous painting that led to it all crashing down. Virginie Amélie, who preferred to go just by her middle name Amélie, was born in the French Quarter of New Orleans in the mid-19th century. When her father died fighting in the Civil War, Amélie moved with her mother to Paris at only 8 years old. From the start, her mother carefully groomed Amélie for an advantageous marriage, and at the age of 19, she married a wealthy businessman over twice her age. But marriage did not stop her from becoming Paris's hottest it girl. Though famous for her hourglass figure, Amélie was not otherwise conventionally attractive. Instead, she carefully constructed her own image into a performative persona, coating her face with powder and dyeing her hair with henna. She became known around Paris for her provocative outfits and outlandish maquillage, and soon gained celebrity status. Her unique look attracted many of the best artists of her day, but none wanted to paint her more than fellow American John Singer Sargent, an ambitious young portrait painter making a name for himself amongst the upper classes of Paris. Though she turned down numerous other requests, Amélie eventually accepted Sargent's pleas and agreed to have him paint her. For Sargent and Amélie actually had a lot in common. Both American and outsiders to French culture, artist and sitter were equally eager to infiltrate Parisian high society. Though both successful in their own right, Amélie as socialite and Sargent as painter, they began to see Amélie's portrait as their big break into the inner circles of the impenetrable French elite. But their plan would quickly take a dark turn. Though universally considered a masterpiece today, when Amélie's portrait was first exhibited at the Salon of 1884, it sparked one of the greatest uproars in the history of art. There were two main culprits that caused, as one contemporary noted, onlookers to scream every curse word in the French language. The first was that it would have been apparent to contemporary viewers that Amélie was not wearing any underwear, leaving viewers horrified. But even more shocking was that one of the straps of Amélie's dress had slipped off her shoulder, daringly suggesting that her dress could slip off at any moment. To Sargent's shock and Amélie's dismay, this fallen strap left all of Paris speechless, and before they knew it, both artist and sitter were caught in one of the biggest social scandals Paris had ever seen. Sargent hurriedly took the portrait back to his studio and repainted Amélie's fallen strap so that it fit properly on her shoulder. His reputation tarnished, he fled to England and locked the portrait in his studio for the next two decades. Amélie did not have the same privilege. She remained in Paris and tried to regain her status in high society. But she could never fully recover from the portrait's disaster. As she grew older, she became more and more of a recluse, until she died at the age of 56, alone and in relative obscurity. Amélie did not live long enough to witness her portrait become one of the most beloved paintings in the world. Today, Madame X's mysterious title leaves Amélie's own legacy in the shadows. In this episode, we aim to honor Amélie not just as a bold society woman, but as an avant-garde creative in her own right, whose carefully fashioned look and persona was a form of performance art well ahead of its time. And as an American woman who dared to challenge the limited Parisian society in which she lived, unafraid to show off a little shoulder and present herself as sexually confident and proud. So without further ado, let's dive in. Virginie Amélie Avenio was born on January 29, 1859, in the French Quarter of New Orleans, Louisiana. Both her father and mother came from pure Creole roots and spoke exclusively in French. Her father, Anatole Avenio, came from a family heavily invested in real estate and owned some of the largest properties in the city. Her mother, Marie Virginie Ternault, came from a family of plantation owners. There is no denying that Amélie's maternal side was deeply invested in and profited off of slavery. The plantation Marie was raised on had over 145 slaves working on the property. Amélie was born into immense wealth. By today's standards, her family's net worth was well into the millions. Most of this money came from her family's plantation, which produced sugarcane, cotton, and indigo. Because of this, Amélie would have had a very privileged upbringing, receiving a proper education and given opulent allowances. Amélie grew up in New Orleans at the height of its glory. Considered by many to be the most glamorous and decadent city in the United States, it was a popular destination for travelers looking for a good time. Its Mardi Gras parade drew in spectators from America and Europe alike, and it was the first city in the country to have its own opera season. Its prominent French Quarter, where Creole descendants of the first French settlers of New Orleans lived, was seen as a sister city to Paris. Proud of their heritage, most people living in the French Quarter spoke only in French, refusing to speak English. Amélie fell in this camp and would have been raised with French as her native tongue. When at 2 years old, she welcomed in a younger sister named Valentine, Amélie's family appeared the picture-perfect Southern Quattro, two little Southern belles being raised within one of the richest households in the city. But her fairy tale childhood would soon come crashing down. By 1860, talk of a division between the North and South was abound, and it soon became clear that America was on the brink of a civil war. Unwilling to abolish slavery, troops rallied in New Orleans to fight for the Confederacy. In September of 1861, Amélie's father enlisted in the 13th Louisiana Infantry and headed to war. Unfortunately, just a few months in, her father's leg was badly wounded in battle and had to be amputated. On the train ride back to New Orleans, his wounds became infected, and he died before he could make it home. At just 3 years old, Amélie had lost her father. Amélie's father's death drastically changed the course of her life. Though her family did have wealth to lean on, her mother had become a young widow overnight. With the South torn by war, her family's business at stake, and now without her husband, Amélie's mother was faced with the challenge of raising two young girls on her own. And soon, tragedy would strike again. In March of 1866, Amélie's younger sister Valentine contracted congestive fever and died shortly after, at the mere age of 5. Amélie watched as her baby sister was buried alongside her father, never to see either again. How did Amélie feel to lose both her father and sister in such a short amount of time? Was she heartbroken? Devastated? Speechless that her once magical life could turn so dark so quickly? Was she afraid that she might be next? After the consecutive losses of her husband and youngest daughter, Amélie's mother Marie was ready for a fresh start. New Orleans was shattered from the war, and it left a depressing and unstable atmosphere. Looking around her, it became clear to Marie that there was no real future for her and Amélie in Louisiana. In 1867, she bravely decided to relocate with Amélie to Paris, where her family had an apartment. The move made sense. They spoke fluent French, had a landing pad and family there to settle them. And while New Orleans was reeling from the after effects of the war, Paris was still one of the greatest cities in the world. And so, Marie and Amélie set sail for France, leaving behind their home for a land unknown. As historian Deborah Davis elegantly wrote, Marie's move to Paris was more than just a change of setting. It was a brave first step towards a new life. The day she left New Orleans, she assumed a role that was unfamiliar and perhaps a little frightening. At age 30, she became the matriarch of her own family. There is no denying the courage it took for Marie to embark on a new life for her and her daughter. Leaving their home country was a radical decision, but she had made a promise to herself to do whatever she needed to ensure that her sole surviving daughter had only the brightest of futures. Amélie first arrived in Paris when she was 8 years old. How did she feel as she took her first steps in her new city? Did she miss the bustling energy of the French Quarter, or was she overcome with a sense of wonder? As she looked up at the sparkling city around her, did her eyes sparkle back with amazement? We can only imagine the awe Amélie must have felt as she first walked the streets of Paris. Compared to war-torn New Orleans, Paris was in the midst of an architectural boom. Department stores and large apartment buildings were popping up across the city, and the streets were lined with freshly trimmed trees. Amélie and her mother moved into a series of apartments within their family's residence, and must have been comforted to be surrounded by relatives and other Louisiana Creoles who had relocated to Paris. Marie almost immediately took to grooming Amélie into the perfect Parisian young woman. She enrolled Amélie into a prestigious convent school, where Amélie received an impressive education, fit for a cultivated lady. Understanding that the best way to secure Amélie's future was through a favorable marriage, Marie poured her whole life into priming Amélie for a suitable husband. As she grew into a teenager, Amélie began attending musical evenings and tea parties, always accompanied by her mother. These parties were not only a way to integrate Amélie into high society, but also to subtly start scouting for a potential spouse. For Amélie had grown into a stunning young woman. She had what every woman dreams of, an hourglass figure with a narrow waist, large bosom, and perfectly formed feminine curves. Her extra long neck gave her an elegant, almost swan-like appearance, and she had beautiful copper hair, dark, magnetic eyes, and skin clear as marble. These graceful attributes lessened the severity of her large Romanesque nose, inherited from her father. It didn't take long for Amélie to attract a streamline of impressive suitors. But when the man who would take Amélie's hand in marriage came along, he was far from Prince Charming. Pierre-Louis Gautreau was a wealthy 40-year-old businessman with a lucrative bank account and country home in Brittany to show for himself. The Gautreau family had built a fortune through banking and the shipping industry. They also imported fertilizer from Central America, a surprisingly successful enterprise. Pierre took charge of the family's fertilizer business and often traveled to Chile to supervise the import. Because of this, many jokingly called him Pedro. Though fertilizer is far from glamorous, Pierre had more than enough impressive titles to make up for it. He was a commanding captain for the French army, as well as a member of the Legion of Honor. More than twice Amélie's age, of below average height, with a thick beard and permanently serious expression, Amélie's union with Pierre was far from romantic. But Amélie was willing to trade romance for the perks of having a well-off husband. And though marriage had its limitations, in Amélie's time, women were actually able to enjoy more societal freedom as a married woman. To start, married women could go anywhere in society as long as her husband accompanied her. And protected under her husband's name, she had more leeway to bend Paris's suffocating social rules and get away with naughtier behavior. She had free rein to flirt, wear provocative outfits, and act with more impropriety. For the free-spirited Amélie, marriage was a one-way ticket to living a louder and fun-filled life. And so, on August 1st of 1878, Amélie and Pierre Gautreau officially tied the knot. Amélie was only 19 years old, and Pierre over 40. On her wedding day, Amélie wore an expensive velvet gown and eye-popping jewelry to match. In attendance was her grandmother, who traveled all the way from Louisiana to witness her big day. Amélie's marriage signified much more than just an impressive name to attach herself to. Though somewhat ironic, in many ways it was her first day as a free woman. After the wedding, Amélie and her new husband enjoyed a honeymoon in Belgium. But the real fun began once Amélie returned to Paris to establish her new life as Madame Gautreau, for there were many perks of her new life to look forward to. Amélie moved in with Pierre into a four-story grand home in today's 17th arrondissement, which she excitedly decorated with luxurious furniture, decor, and art. Building a new home was her first step towards establishing her own life away from her domineering mother, and more than this, developing her voice as a modern Parisian woman. To fund her new lifestyle, Amélie received a monthly allowance of 300 francs, as well as charge accounts to the city's finest department stores. And soon, Amélie was ready to make a splash in Paris's social scene. Amélie knew that to make a name for herself, she would need to stand out amongst the other Parisian society women. She set out to create a unique look and persona, one that would cause jaws to drop and eyes to bulge. Amélie invested an immense amount of careful preparation and creativity to plan her grand entrance into French high society. To dramatize her look, she whitened her skin with white rice powder, dyed her hair with henna, wore a bold red lipstick, and emphasized her eyebrows with brown pencil. She ordered custom outfits made to enhance her hourglass figure, outlining every curve of her voluptuous body to leave little to the imagination. Her look was dramatic and bold, and sure to turn heads. And after a few months' prep, Amélie was ready to step into the spotlight. How did Amélie feel as she geared herself up for her big break in Parisian society as a married woman? Was she worried that she wouldn't be accepted? That her look was too daring? Or was she buzzing with excitement? When she twirled herself in front of her mirror, did she give herself an encouraging wink? Amélie made her official debut as Madame Gautreau in October of 1878. Her contrasting makeup and scandalous outfits quickly turned her into the talk of the town. Attending dinner parties, fancy balls, and events, men and women alike became captivated with Amélie's one-of-a-kind look and daring persona. Her appearances at events became a sort of spectacle. Crowds anxiously gathered to catch a glimpse of Amélie's look du jour, and on some occasions she even caused traffic jams. It didn't take long before Amélie became a full-fledged Parisian celebrity, and Amélie ate all the attention right up. But though Amélie was able to skirt her duties as wife to climb the social ladders of Paris, she couldn't evade becoming a mother. In late autumn of 1878, Amélie became pregnant with her first child. She tried to conceal her pregnancy for as long as she could, continuing to attend galas and balls. But when it became impossible to hide her growing belly, she confined herself inside for the final weeks of her pregnancy. That following August, Amélie gave birth to a healthy baby girl, whom she named Louise after her late mother-in-law. Always ready to party, Amélie threw a massive event for Louise's baptism, serving champagne and oysters. Barely 20 herself, Amélie was ready to jump back into her social life as soon as she could. She wanted to ascend to even higher ranks within Paris's elite. She continued to perfect her look, with outlandish gowns and dramatic makeup. Her presence at balls, bazaars, operas, and salons began to be demanded by society members, all eager to see Amélie's ever-changing appearance. In fact, there were days when Amélie changed her outfit up to a staggering 8 times, attending different events throughout the day. And her hard work certainly paid off. Newspapers clamored to cover Amélie's latest look, always giving her more than favorable reviews. One article from 1880 gushed over Amélie, writing, "Her head is classical, and she wears her naturally wavy hair in Grecian bandeau. At first sight, one is literally stunned by her beauty, which her dress sets off. In shape and color, the ensemble and details are perfect. Madame Gautreau is a statue of Canova, transmitted into flesh and blood and bone and muscle. All her contours are harmonious. I know she is the loveliest creature I ever beheld coming out of the hands of a Paris dressmaker. A murmur of admiration greeted her wherever she went. Over the course of the next 3 years, Amélie's fame skyrocketed, and she became known not just around Paris, but all across Europe. Crowds hoarded everywhere she went, desperate for a chance to see the famous Parisian socialite. Even the King of Bavaria traveled to Paris with the sole purpose of witnessing Amélie attend the opera. And the Imperial Highness of Austria invited Amélie to her gardens in Corfu. But none worshipped her more than the rising artists of Paris, appreciating her costuming and makeup as an art form in its own right. They begged to have the opportunity to translate Amélie's unique look onto canvas. They loved her unconventionality and trailblazing style, and considered Amélie to be the most interesting woman in all of Paris. Many developed crushes on her and called her a goddess. One artist was even known to spy on Amélie, unable to keep his eyes off of her. She became flooded with requests to have her portrait painted, but Amélie refused every offer. She knew that her first portrait should not be done by any old artist. Of course, everyone sought a flattering portrait, and artists were expected to make idealized versions of their subjects, accentuating their best features. But more than this, one's portrait officially marked their entrance into high society. It wasn't just a portrait superficially, but also a statement of one's character. It certainly wasn't a decision to take lightly, for these portraits were often exhibited at the famous annual Salon. The Salon attracted hundreds of thousands of visitors each year, who scrutinized each work attentively. The best and worst works were received with a great amount of publicity. Having your portrait exhibited at the Salon could make or break both the artist and sitter's reputation. Amélie attended the Salon each year as a guest, less so interested in the art and more so interested in flaunting her latest outfit. A newspaper wrote of Amélie's arrival at the Salon 1 year. Later on, Madame Gautreau, who does things in a way of art but always distracts the artistic eye when she appears, she strolled through the rooms, finding more interest in admiring the throngs than in the paintings. But Amélie was ready to be more than just a spectator. She wanted her portrait to make her the spectacle of the Salon. She needed someone with a special and rare talent who could make as big a splash as she had on Paris's social scene. She didn't just want a portrait. She wanted a masterpiece. She just needed the perfect artist. John Singer Sargent moved to Paris at the age of 18 to study art. Though considered American, he had never actually been to America. His father was a doctor from Philadelphia, but when he married Sargent's adventurous mother, they moved to Europe. Sargent's mother loved nothing more than to travel, so the family lived a transient life, drifting through various European cities. Sargent showed early signs of artistic talent and expressed his desire to be an artist at the age of 13. In 1874, he was accepted into the studio of the prominent Parisian portrait painter Carolus Duran. It was clear early on that Sargent had an unusual gift. His paintings left not only his fellow students, but also his teacher in awe. Soon after, he began submitting his work to the Salon. His first few submissions were received extremely favorably, and word spread of his impressive talent as a portraitist. His success at the Salon drove in commissions from some of the wealthiest families in the city and granted him connections to Paris's elite circles. It was through these powerful connections that Sargent first became aware of Amélie. Sargent was commissioned to paint a portrait of a man named Samuel John Pozzi, a gynecologist not only admired for his impeccable medical skill, but also a notorious ladies' man around Paris. Pozzi, who was very unhappily married, had recently become infatuated with Amélie. He confessed his feelings for her over an afternoon tea, and their affair officially began soon after. Both handsome and desired by every woman around Paris, Amélie gleefully accepted Pozzi's advances. Though not unhappily married, she did not have the most exciting of marriages, and saw her relationship with her husband as mainly transactional. And in fact, Amélie's affair with Pozzi was not her first. There were rumors that Amélie was previously involved with a politician named Léon Gambetta, as well as a diplomat named Ferdinand de Lesseps. De Lesseps, who developed the Suez Canal, was in his 70s when the then 19-year-old Amélie became his lover. That is all to say, Amélie's fling with Pozzi was far from her first rodeo. Pozzi was absolutely smitten with Amélie. He loved her long, swan-like neck, narrow waist, and dark, mysterious eyes. By the time Sargent began his portrait of Pozzi, Amélie and Pozzi were at the peak of their affair and couldn't take their hands off each other. Amélie attended all of Pozzi's portrait sittings, batting her eyes and flirting with him every chance she had. Though Sargent was focused on his subject, he couldn't help but notice the exceptionally beautiful Amélie on the sidelines. When he was finished with Pozzi's portrait, Sargent became obsessed over the possibility of painting Amélie. He wrote to a friend, "I have a great desire to paint her portrait, and have reason to think she would allow it, and is waiting for someone to propose this homage to her beauty." But Sargent's desire to paint Amélie was far from selfless. While his career was doing relatively well, gaining a steady flow of commissions from Paris's upper crust, he hadn't yet become as famous as he aspired to be. He needed a work that would catapult his career as the top portraitist in Paris, and for this masterpiece, he needed the perfect model. Sargent found everything about Amélie utterly enchanting, from her copper hair, to her quirky outfits, to her bewitching laugh. Both American, and therefore outsiders in Paris, and sharing an insatiable thirst for fame, Sargent also saw a lot of himself in the young socialite. She began to haunt his every thought. He knew he had found his muse for his next greatest work, the work that would turn him into a household name and send all of Paris abuzz. Sargent began to send Amélie urgent pleas to paint her portrait. And though she had turned away request after request from other artists, much to Sargent's pleasant surprise, in February of 1883, Amélie actually agreed. For Amélie also saw in Sargent her own opportunity for glory. She trusted him to be the one to translate her unique spirit onto canvas and elevate her growing status within society to newfound heights. And so the rising American portraitist began his painting of the famous American beauty, both ready to carve their way into the heart of Paris. Though Sargent had hoped he could begin the portrait that winter, Amélie's endless social obligations caused her to break appointment after appointment. She eventually suggested that Sargent join her that summer in her country home in Brittany, where she would have more downtime to properly pose. Eager to get started, Sargent happily accepted her invite. In Brittany, he began to sketch Amélie in various poses, standing, slumped on the sofa like a broody adolescent, and in one pretending to read a book. Sargent's fascination with Amélie is palpable in these drawings, and she appears both dreamy and alluring. It's also clear in these initial sketches that both Sargent and Amélie were not yet fully comfortable with each other as artist and model, for Amélie did not prove to be the easiest model. Young, restless, spoiled rotten, and extremely willful, Amélie found the process of posing unbearingly boring. She detested doing anything that felt like a job, and struggled to sit still and follow Sargent's instructions. Though she had promised to have more time in her summer home for posing, She often canceled modeling sessions to host parties and get-togethers with friends. In a letter from this time, an exasperated sergeant wrote, "Madame Gautreau is at the piano and driving all my ideas away." He struggled to capture what he dubbed as the unpaintable beauty and hopeless laziness of Madame Gautreau, and found the easiest way to depict the antsy Amélie was through quick sketches. One such oil sketch is titled "Madame Gautreau Drinking a Toast." Quickly painted at the dinner table, Sargent shows Amélie in the midst of making a toast. She stretches her arm out invitingly as she holds her champagne glass towards a dinner guest not caught on canvas. Is the toast for her husband? For one of her many lovers? Or is it for us? Here Amélie is a sensual goddess, enhanced by her dreamy expression, soft features, and transparent pink lace shawl that teasingly shows off her low-cut dress. Sargent's infatuation with Amélie is obvious, and you can feel the artist's awe in every romanticized detail. Sargent's loose brushstrokes adds to the sketch's intoxicating feel, and one cannot help but want to pull up a chair and join her in raising a glass. But Sargent's frustration was beginning to overpower his admiration for Amélie. Several months had gone by, and he had little to show for it. That July, he decided to return to Paris, depleted of all artistic inspiration. He needed a break from the sassy socialite and to clear his spinning head, and it seemed that the break helped. After a few months of focusing on other projects, Sargent was hit by a vision. He now knew exactly how he wanted to capture the elusive Amélie, and better yet, the dress that he would paint her in. When Sargent finally painted Amélie that autumn, he no longer had the same tolerance for her frivolous antics. He had to make up for a lot of lost time. He positioned Amélie standing confidently, with her right arm leaning against a table, as she turned her head sideways. For someone who detested modeling, this must have been an incredibly uncomfortable pose for Amélie to hold for long stretches of time. Perhaps Sargent's revenge on her. Her strained neck muscles and tense arm, testament to her discomfort. But perhaps most notably, Sargent, who always picked his models' outfits, dressed Amélie in a sleek, form-fitting black gown, designed for Amélie by one of Paris's best designers. Sargent selected the dress because he felt it best captured her spirit. And soon his big aha moment would happen. One day while Amélie was posing, one of the jeweled straps of her dress slipped off her shoulder. Though an accident, Sargent's eyes lit with excitement. This fallen strap was the perfect detail to turn his portrait of Amélie into a masterpiece. It was daring, but so was Amélie. Sargent no longer needed Amélie to finish his portrait of her. He spent the next few months scrutinizing every detail, trying to get his triumph of a work to perfect form for the upcoming salon. In fact, he reworked the painting so many times that he began to make a copy of the painting, worrying he had damaged the surface of the original with too many edits. While Amélie was busy attending parties and galas, Sargent tossed and turned at night, overthinking his every stroke. By that February, he finally surrendered and submitted the original work to be exhibited at the salon. A year after he had first begun drawing Amélie, her portrait was finally ready for the public's eye. In this final portrait submitted to the 1884 Salon, we see a life-size Amélie standing brazenly as she turns her head away from us. She is every inch a femme fatale, seductive, sultry, and dangerously attractive. Her slim waist and large bosom flaunt her perfect feminine figure. Her hair pulled back reveals her swan-like neck, and her face and profile shows off her prominent nose. She gracefully flaunts a few accessories, a black fan, a wedding ring, and a shiny tiara on top of her head. Her whitened skin gives us a sense of Amelie's notorious makeup, which accentuates her reddened ear and crimson lips, two rare points of bright color within the muted work. Placed in a brown, atmospheric background, Amelie feels suspended in a timeless and placeless backdrop. And then, of course, there is her dress. Amelie's dress emphasizes every curve of her body, with its heart-shaped bodice and black satin fabric. It is the definition of chic, a simple yet elegant design that turns Amelie into a sultry creature of the night. But the most scandalous details about the dress may be lost on audiences today. To start, its tight fit would have required a piece of underwear called a petticoat, which acted as a barrier between the dress and one's nude body. And yet, Amelie wears none. As a dress historian of the Fashion Institute of New York stated, Amelie's dress came to a deep, sharp point over the crotch. Though the cuirass would have had some kind of lining to soak up sweat, the model would not have been wearing any underwear. The second detail is, of course, the fallen strap. Is the fallen strap the loose thread that will make the whole dress unravel? The strap acts as a reminder that Amelie's dress just barely covers her body and could fall at any moment to reveal her naked form. Word started to spread that this year's salon would include a portrait of Paris's hottest socialite. Well before the exhibition's opening, Parisians were eager to catch sight of Sargent's latest work. How did Amelie feel in the weeks leading up to the salon? Was she worried that the painting was too risque? That Paris wasn't ready for such a bold portrait of a woman? Or was she confident that her portrait would be a success like Paris had never before seen? Did she buzz with excitement over the fame and glory that was just within her grasp? While Sargent waited anxiously, nervously, writing to a friend, "Will it be good? Will it be bad? Or will they say nothing at all?" Amelie remained cool, calm, and collected. She knew the painting had its risks, but risks had never stopped her in the past. She truly believed that the painting was a masterpiece and was filled with an overwhelming sense of pride. Though Sargent was apprehensive, Amelie felt in her bones that the painting would not only bring them success, but that their shared goal of rising to the top ranks of Parisian society was right on the horizon. And so, in August of 1884, the salon opened its doors to the public. Amelie dressed herself in her most impressive outfit yet, and as she walked through its doors, she smiled at the thought of all the praise she would soon be receiving. She knew that people were coming to this year's salon specifically to see her portrait, and she was ready to be seen. Her portrait was located towards the end of the exhibition, in room 31. And visitors had to weave through many rooms before landing on Sargent's portrait. Upon entering the room, visitors were met with a life-size Amelie, so realistic that it felt like Amelie herself was greeting them in the flesh. Initial reviews of the portrait were positive. One newspaper wrote that it was of rare distinction and interest. But it didn't take long for all hell to break loose. By the time visitors reached Amelie's portrait, they would have seen plenty of nudes. In fact, exhibition goers expected and looked forward to seeing nudes in the show. But these nudes would have been painted in a classical style, often set in pastoral or heavenly backscapes with idealized forms. They were always detached from reality. Fantastical, lovely, and very much not real. When Manet exhibited Olympia nearly 20 years earlier, it sent shockwaves through Paris for depicting a real nude woman. Two decades later, the Parisian art scene was clearly still not ready for such a realistic depiction of female sexuality. And here is where the fallen strap comes in. Though not nude, Amelie's fallen strap depicted a real woman, whose dress could slip off and reveal her naked body at any given moment. Despite seeing nude after nude before reaching Amelie's portrait, visitors immediately gasped when they saw her fallen strap. This strap, as far as they were concerned, was either the precursor to or aftermath of sex, and left Amelie naked as could be. Onlookers shrieked in horror, cursed loudly in disbelief, and shook their heads in disgust. In the blink of an eye, the public had made their disapproval loud and clear. Amelie was chastised as shameless, amplified by the fact that in her portrait she looks away nonchalantly, indifferent to her promiscuity. Women in particular were appalled by the work. So much so that for entertainment, men waited by the portrait just to watch women's dramatic reactions as they came upon the painting. It caused such an uproar that within a matter of a few hours, talk of Amelie's scandalous portrait spread through the entire city, and hordes of people came rushing to the salon to see the work for themselves. Newspapers began to publish scathing review after scathing review. One such review wrote, "Mr. Sargent made a mistake if he thinks he expressed the shattering beauty of his model. Even recognizing certain qualities that the painting has, we are shocked by the spineless expression and the vulgar character of the figure." Another snarky review wrote, "Of all the undressed women at the salon this year, the most interesting is Madame Gautreau, because of the indecency of her dress that looks like it is about to fall off." Critics called the painting nauseating and hideous, and denounced both artist and subject for their indecency. Caricatures of Amelie and Sargent spread, which made fun of Amelie's nose, makeup, and large breasts. The painting, that they had both dreamed would bring them everlasting stardom, had instead turned them into the laughingstocks of Paris. Though Sargent had had his concerns, he was not at all prepared for such a strong reaction. His paintings had always been well received at the salon, and he was left completely stunned by the public's outcry. But perhaps even more shocked than Sargent was Amelie, who had been so sure of the painting's potential. It was as if her worst nightmare was coming true before her eyes. She became hysteric, sobbing in the corner of the salon, her makeup dripping down her face dramatically. As one of her friends described, "As for the model, slumped in a corner, she cries real tears, despite her enamel over her offended beauty. The beautiful Madame is horrible in daylight. Chalky paint gives to the tone of a corpse." Amelie must have felt like the ground was quickly slipping from under her feet. How could what she thought would be the most glorious day of her life have turned so dark so quickly? A few hours after the opening, Amelie's mother scooped her off the floor and stormed toward Sargent's studio. She was enraged over the public's reaction, and more so, at the artist who had put her daughter in such a compromising position. Her mother, who had bravely moved them to Paris as a widow and dedicated her whole life to raising Amelie into the perfect Parisian society woman, had sacrificed too much for all her hard work to be thrown out the window over a measly painting. This was Sargent's fault, and Sargent would have to pay. Pounding on the door, Amelie and her mother were dismayed to hear that Sargent wasn't there. They waited furiously for hours until he returned. As soon as he approached, Amelie's mother demanded that he remove the painting immediately, desperately exclaiming that if he didn't, Amelie might die of grief. She then screamed at the top of her lungs, "My daughter is ruined, and all of Paris mocks her," glaring at Sargent with the piercing eyes of a protective mother. But much to their dismay, the stubborn Sargent refused. Yes, it was a shockingly bad first day, but he wanted to give his masterpiece time to gain the recognition it deserved. Amelie and her mother stormed out of his studio, disgruntled and disappointed. And though Sargent was steadfast at first to keep the portrait in the show, as the days went on and the negative reviews piled even higher, he began to reconsider his decision. He conjured a plan to remove the painting and repaint the fallen strap so that it fit properly on her shoulder, and then bring the painting back. But senior members of the salon's jury told him that removing and altering a painting was in violation of the salon's rules. Now, also much to Sargent's dismay, the portrait would have to remain in the exhibition for the duration of the show, the provocative fallen strap in full view for all to ridicule. Also to his dismay, Sargent had assumed he could sell Amélie's portrait to her husband for a hefty price. But now, given the controversy, not only did the Gautreaux want nothing to do with the work, Sargent would have a hard time selling it to anyone. Finally, after an excruciating few weeks, the salon closed and Sargent was able to remove Amélie's portrait from the public scrutiny. He hurriedly took the painting back to his studio and erased all traces of Amélie's fallen strap, repainting the strap upright. Knowing this edit was moot after such an uproar and that he had no chance of selling the work, Sargent decided to lock the portrait in his studio, where it would remain for the next 20 years. His reputation in Paris now ruined, Sargent slunk away to England, leaving behind not only a massive controversy, but also a devastated Amélie. Unlike Sargent, Amélie had no escape from the nightmare that had become her reality. Once Paris's it girl, she couldn't believe how far she had fallen. She had worked so hard to be accepted by Parisian high society, overcoming the obstacle of being an American, and now she was a social pariah. In the months following the salon, Amélie suffered through endless slandering gossip columns, ridiculing caricatures and cackles everywhere she went. We can only imagine the humiliation Amélie must have felt on a daily basis. Before the salon, she attended every social gathering she could, but now she was too embarrassed to attend most. The few she did, she stood off to the side, away from the spotlight she once adored. After a few taxing weeks in Paris, Amélie decided to get away to her summer home in Brittany to recoup. Here she kept a low profile, slowly trying to build back her confidence to re-enter Parisian society. She knew she had no other choice but to make the best of her mortifying situation. As a social creature, she missed party hopping across the city more than anything. She made a vow to herself that she would hold her head high and no longer recoil in shame. She decided to pretend as if her portrait never existed. The painting was locked away, and she planned to lock its memory with it. After a few weeks, she was ready to return to Paris with a renewed sense of self, confident, unshakable, and unafraid to take center stage. That September, Amélie hosted a charity event to raise money towards victims of cholera and made her first real appearance since the salon. How did Amélie feel as she hosted her own event? Was she ready to once again be in the spotlight? Was she worried that she may continue to be ridiculed? Or did she have a resounding faith in herself that she could rebound back into society and become even more beloved than before? Hosting her own event reminded Amélie how essential socializing was to her very being. She spent the next 3 years desperately trying to remain socially relevant. She attended any event she could, no matter how big or small, always dressed in her finest clothes. With each gala, ball, and dance she attended, she hopelessly longed for her big comeback. But sadly, it never came. Though she didn't receive any bad press, almost worse, she didn't receive any press at all. Her attempts at reclaiming her social status seemed to fall on deaf ears. Much to Amélie's dismay, she went almost completely unnoticed. With her 30th birthday approaching, she knew she was running out of time. What would she need to do to be noticed again? And how could she reclaim her past glory? It suddenly dawned on Amélie. The best way to erase the damage of Sargent's portrait was to commission a new portrait, one by a different artist, and one she had more control over. Once again, she knew she needed to pick an artist carefully. She didn't want a portrait that was too conventional, but she also couldn't risk it going rogue again. She eventually settled on the painter Gustave Courtois, an up-and-coming portraitist still looking for his big break in the art world. Because of this, he would be eager to paint her portrait, but also easily manipulated so that this time she had control over the outcome. Not surprisingly, Courtois promptly accepted the commission. And so, 7 years after Sargent painted his infamous portrait of Amélie, she was ready to be captured on canvas again. In Courtois' portrait titled Madame Gautreau, we see a matured Amélie. Taking full ownership of her image, Amélie dressed herself in a white virginal gown, the polar opposite of the dress that Sargent painted her in years prior. Her head is again in profile, this time to the right, proudly showing off her long neck and prominent nose. But the most striking detail of the work may come with some surprise. In the painting, Amélie's left shoulder strap falls down her shoulder. Here, Amélie is making a deliberate reference to Sargent's portrait, while letting us know that this time the decision is her own. It is Amélie's brave attempt to reclaim her authority over her own image and rewrite her own history. As Amélie smiles over her shoulder confidently, she is almost daring her critics to a rematch. The painting was exhibited in the Salon of 1891. Amélie had high hopes that her portrait would once again become the talk of the town. As the years had dragged on, Amélie realized that the only thing worse than bad press was no press at all. The public's indifference to her stung far greater than any insult she had endured, and she longed to once again be relevant. Fortunately, despite her daring reference to Sargent's work, her portrait went almost completely unnoticed. This time, the fallen strap barely raised an eyebrow. Amélie was beside herself. She now had a new nightmare to face. The public had downright forgotten about her. Amélie was not yet ready to throw in the towel. She exhausted herself attending event after event, slinking further and further into the background. Once escorted by the most dashing men of her day, Amélie struggled to find suitable escorts. Still preferring the company of other men to her husband, the only men willing to accompany Amélie were old and washed-out ambassadors. And in one desperate case, she even attended an opera with a 15-year-old boy. As she neared 40, she stubbornly tried to maintain the look she was once famous for. She continued to dye her graying hair with henna and coated on even more face powder to hide her aging skin. It became harder and harder for her to keep up appearances. Her body, once a perfect hourglass figure, plumped with age, and she could no longer fit into her skin-tight gowns. While Amélie struggled to accept her age, her daughter, Louise, was blossoming into a beautiful young woman. Now 22 years old, Louise was just as dazzling and lively as Amélie had once been. We can imagine that Amélie felt mixed emotions about her daughter. As a mother, she was proud that her daughter had grown into such an exquisite young lady. But it also made her face her own inner demons. As her daughter prepared herself to enter society, Amélie knew she must prepare herself to exit it. When in 1901, Louise married a wealthy lawyer, Amélie could not bring herself to attend the wedding. With her daughter married off, Amélie was also left to face her own crumbling marriage. As the years went on, Amélie and her husband had become more and more estranged, taking separate vacations and spending all of their evenings apart. With their daughter now out of the house, they decided to more officially separate and take up their own residences. Amélie moved into an apartment on the same street as the Eiffel Tower, in a lovely residential building with a courtyard and garden. In the comfort of her new home, Amelie kept mostly to herself. As the years went on, she slipped further and further away from the fame she had once enjoyed as a young socialite, and lived a largely hermetic life. Though Amelie in the flesh kept predominantly indoors, her infamous portrait was about to see the light of day for the first time in 2 decades. After years of refusing to ever exhibit the painting again, in 1905, Sargent begrudgingly agreed to include the painting of Amelie in an exhibition in London. Though Amelie did not receive an official invite, she got word that her portrait would once again be on view to the public. How did Amelie feel, knowing that the work that had sent her life into utter chaos would be leaving the safety of Sargent's studio? Was she worried that it might spark another uproar? That she would once again become the laughingstock of the art world? Or was she exhilarated by the prospect of the painting's second chance? Much to Amelie's delight, her portrait received rave reviews. In fact, even the Emperor of Germany attended the opening and declared it his favorite painting in the exhibition. He wanted the work to travel to Berlin after the show, and asked Amelie for her help with convincing Sargent to release the painting. Though Amelie hadn't spoken to Sargent in years, she gleefully jumped at the opportunity to help arrange her portrait to travel to Germany. Unfortunately, Sargent's reply to Amelie was curt and cold. He would not exhibit the work in Berlin. Once again, Amelie was at the whim of Sargent's stubborn will, and had to swallow the fact that she had no real agency over her own image. But the painting's newfound success did encourage Amelie to treat herself to a trip to Cannes. Spending most of her time shuttered indoors in Paris, she greatly enjoyed the opportunity to swim and breathe in the fresh sea air. But what should have been a restorative trip took a grave turn. One day, as Amelie walked along the beach, she overheard 2 women making fun of her. One snarkily commenting that her physical splendor had totally disappeared. Amelie's eyes welled with tears, and she ran back to her hotel, wounded and ashamed. The next day, Amelie arranged for a car to take her home to Paris. Though she had once craved the public's attention more than anything, Amelie made a promise to herself on the long ride back home that she would never be seen or ridiculed again. Amelie would spend the rest of her years as a complete recluse. She shut all of her blinds and only left her house late at night under the protective veil of darkness. In Brittany, she was known to walk the beach of St. Malo in the hours before dawn, wrapped in white cloth to hide her face. And she not only avoided the outside world, but also her own image. Amelie had all the mirrors in her apartment in Paris and home in Brittany removed, so that she would never have to look at her own reflection again. Once proudly spending hours in front of a mirror, styling her makeup and outfits, Amelie could no longer bear the sight of her own face. By the time Amelie reached 50, she only allowed her mother, daughter, maid, and on occasion her husband, to visit her. Her family were the only people she now trusted, and she felt a rare sense of safety and security, particularly around her mother and daughter. To the rest of the world, Amelie was but a memory, living on the outskirts of society in total seclusion. Tragically, when Amelie turned 51, her mother Marie passed away at the age of 73. It must have pained Marie, who had bravely moved to Paris with Amelie many years prior and dedicated her whole life to ensuring Amelie's bright future, to leave this world knowing that her daughter had become a complete recluse. Amelie would now have to navigate life without Marie, not only her mother, but also her dearest friend. And as Amelie was still reeling from the death of Marie, just 1 year later, she suddenly and tragically lost her daughter Louise, who contracted a virus and died at the mere age of 32. Still in her prime, Louise had so much life yet to live. We can only imagine how utterly devastated Amélie must have been to lose her mother and daughter within a span of a year. Without Marie and Louise, Amélie was left completely alone. How did Amélie pass her days without them? Was she confined to bed in grief? Did she whisper to them in the middle of the night? What did she miss most about her beloved mother and daughter? And what did she still have to live for? Amélie spent the final years of her life in complete seclusion, until on July 25, 1915, she passed away after contracting a high fever. Amélie was only 56 years old. How did Amélie spend her dying moments? As she took her last labored breaths and looked around her, did she feel the weight of her isolation? Did Amélie die feeling painfully alone? Amélie was buried in the Gautreau Mausoleum in Paraim, France. She was survived by her husband, Pierre, and left behind a detailed will for the distribution of her assets, which included her family's plantation in New Orleans. Amélie's will left her husband in shock and is one of the most mysterious aspects of her story. Much to Pierre's surprise, Amélie bequeathed nothing to her husband. Instead, she split her inheritance between two mysterious men that Pierre and her closest relatives had never heard of. The first man, named Brigadier Amédée Caillaux, allegedly met Amélie in 1890, 25 years earlier, and they enjoyed casual relations ever since, spending every New Year's together. The second, a 60-year-old tax collector named Dominique Henri Favarelli, met Amélie in 1906 and had since spent every autumn with her. Amélie's husband and extended family were stunned. Who were these men? And how did Amélie's relationships with them go unnoticed? Amélie's will gives us valuable insight into the life that Amélie was living behind closed doors, one that was perhaps less pitiful and instead full of passion. As for Amélie's portrait, shortly after her death, Sargent made arrangements for it to be sold to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, who acquired the painting for their collection in 1915. In a letter to the museum, Sargent admittedly wrote, "I suppose it's the best thing I've ever done." Sargent sold the work with one condition, that Amélie's name would be removed from its title. Instead, the work would be known as Madame X. One has to wonder, with Amélie already deceased, why did Sargent decide to leave her name out of her portrait's title? Was it an act of protection, or was it to rob her of the immortality and the claim to fame she so desperately sought after her whole life? Yet even though Sargent left Amélie's name out of the title, she continued to haunt his work for the rest of his life. There were sketches of Amélie found in Sargent's studio from the years of 1906 to 1913, decades after he first painted her. Working from memory, Sargent religiously drew Amélie's face again and again. It seems that Sargent could never fully forget the American beauty whose portrait was the demise of both of their careers in Paris. As Deborah Davis beautifully wrote, "Yet no matter how many women he painted, with their beautiful faces, elegant poses, and fashionable gowns, Sargent kept returning to one image from the past, Madame X." As for Amélie's legacy today, there are still traces of her life in New Orleans. Her grandfather's house has been restored in the French Quarter, where a replica of Madame X hangs in homage to her. Her family's plantation is now a working farm, and her black dress continues to inspire the fashion world. In 1960, the Cuban-American designer Luis Esteve designed a black dress based on Amélie's. In 2008, actress Julianne Moore dressed herself as Madame X for the cover of Harper's Bazaar. And in 2014, Charlize Theron wore a similar dress to the Oscars. But Amélie's greatest legacy is, of course, her portrait. Since its acquisition in 1916, Madame X has been a highlight of the Metropolitan Museum's collection. But Madame X's title keeps Amélie's own name and immense life story in the shadows. So the next time you view Madame X, think of Amélie. Born in New Orleans at the height of its glamour and glitz, losing her father and then her baby sister early in childhood, her brave journey with her mother to Paris at the age of 8, her marriage to Pierre and rise within the social circles of Paris, her avant-garde makeup and costuming that made her famous across Europe, and then, of course, the portrait that catapulted her life into utter chaos. Think of her resilience, her determination to hold her head high amidst society's scorn, her attempt to take ownership of her own image by commissioning a new portrait, and her eventual decision to live the rest of her life hidden away from society. Yet, Amélie's will presents a different narrative than the one history has long presented, that Amélie spent her final years alone as a recluse. Instead, her will points to her enjoying at least 2 different romantic affairs, and perhaps even more. It does beg the question, was Amélie's seclusion from society an empowered choice to remove herself from the society that had outcast her and instead enjoy the remainder of her life with family and lovers behind closed doors? And Amélie's early days as a society woman deserves re-examination as well. Her carefully constructed look and persona, which she used to make a splash within Paris's rigid upper classes, exemplify her uniquely creative spirit. Amélie should be honored not just as a socialite, but as an artist in her own right. Her forward-thinking costuming and makeup were a form of performance art decades before its time. Amélie had the foresight to manipulate her image to her own advantage and the skill to pull it off. The artists of her day recognized this about her, and it's about time that we do, too. And though Madame X is universally admired for its elegance, what is so often missed is the extraordinary collaboration between 2 Americans living in Paris, one an up-and-coming painter, the other a daring and experimental socialite, who managed to expose the limitations of French high society by presenting a portrait of a sexually confident woman. The Salon's rejection of Madame X says much more about the rigidness of the world in which it existed than the portrait itself. We end today's episode with a quote from historian Deborah Davis, who paid tribute to Amélie with the following lines. "The professional beauty whose fashion choices were reported in newspapers and who was rarely seen in the same dress twice, now wears the same gown every day. She is famous as she once wished, but no one ever calls Madame X by her true name, Virginie Amélie Avenio Gautreau." I hope you have enjoyed Art Muse's episode on Virginie Amélie Avenio Gautreau. I have included images, resources, and suggestions for further reading on the Art Muse website and Instagram. Art Muse is produced by Kula Production Company. Today's episode was written by me, your host, Grace Anna. Stay tuned as I continue to share the stories of the women behind some of the world's most important works of art. Until next time, bye for now.